This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2021, held at Faith Builders from August 2 through 6.
So this is Beyond the Books, teaching character and instilling life values. Let's start with a word of prayer. Lord, we come to you and we thank you that you are a great king over all the earth, and yet we can come to you with our need of wisdom, and you have promised to give to us liberally, and promised that you will never scold us for coming to you and asking for wisdom, for strength, for courage. Pray that you would be with our workshop here as we discuss the real purpose of Christian schools and what we can do in our classrooms to instill values and to direct students into the kingdom and serving the kingdom. I pray that you would give us a vision, that you would also give us patience to work with them. Just bless our discussion and help us to be a upbuilding and stimulating discussion for each of us. I pray in Jesus' name, amen. Just by way of introduction, I'm Lyndon Martin and my wife, Joy. We've been married 15 years, that's hard to believe. I used to think those type of people were old. And we have two daughters. Heather is going to turn 12 in September, and Shayna will be 9 in September. So I talked years ago, before we were married, at Anchor in Shippensburg for 2 years. The last 11 years, I've taught at Shade Mountain Mennonite School in Mount Pleasant Mills. It's in Snyder County, north of Harrisburg. Not planning to teach this coming term. We're in the process of determining what the Lord's will is for us in the next phase of life. But I'd like to start with a little illustration that I ran onto a number of years ago. And the original dollar amount of this was much lower because it was a 1952 copyright book. So I went on an inflation calculator and scaled these up. I don't know how accurate it is today with metal prices being so unpredictable, but I think the scale is still the same. So if you take an iron bar that's worth $50, and you turn that iron bar into horseshoes, the same amount of iron is now worth $105. The bar was $50, the horseshoes made from it are $105. If you take that same bar of iron and turn it into needles, it has a value $3,546. Same iron, different end product. The same iron bar turned into penknife blades is worth $32,860. And the same iron bar turned into balance springs for watches is worth $2.5 million. There's no difference in the material. There's no difference in the amount of material. The only difference was what made the difference?
The product
and
the
amount of work put into developing it. And don't you pity the poor iron bar? Well, think of all the drilling and hammering and beating and pounding and rolling and polishing that it would have taken to get that extra value out of it. And yet, without that agony, so to speak, that was necessary to draw out the finer qualities and refine it, it wouldn't have been fitted for that higher realm of service. Think about how much longer a balance spring and a prized family heirloom watch is going to be in service in comparison to a plain iron bar. And isn't that how it is with children, with all of us, and education or growth of any kind? We start out a lot like an iron bar, and although we don't change and our basic DNA doesn't change, the experiences of life and the disciplines of life, when particularly thinking of it in the school sense, can increase our value not in the eyes of God, but to the kingdom of God, our worth, our ability to serve the kingdom. So we know why we have school. This is actually a mission statement of a school, and I left out two words that I'll put up here in a moment. But the educational efforts of the schools are directed toward the development in each pupil, according to his abilities and capacities, of such habits, attitudes, knowledge, and skills as will enable him to live usefully, successfully, and happily in a society. It's not a bad mission statement. Now, I think I could improve on it a little bit, but now here are the two words that I had left out. This is actually a mission statement from Kalamazoo, Michigan's public schools back in about the 60s. Educational efforts of the public schools are to do all of that so that he can live usefully, successfully, and happily in a democratic society. I have a problem with those two words. But maybe, going back to our earlier discussion, why spend the effort, the expense, to have a Christian day school? And we know the correct answers. The public school's corrupt. We don't want to send our children there. We don't want them learning all of the language and all of the ruining their innocency. We have to send them to school because the law says that we have to send them to school, right? And have to be there till they're 15, 16, whatever the law is. So the public school and the Christian school are parallel in their goals in the fact that they're both trying to pass on heritage. We talked a little bit about that in our warm-up. They're trying to pass on heritage, but where they're not parallel is what heritage they're going to pass on. What is the goal? What are we passing on? The public school is focused on the kingdom of this world. They're worried about producing citizens to live in an earthly kingdom, and they're very humanistic in that. Whereas the Christian school is saying, we want servants in the kingdom of Christ on earth who are fit to be translated into the heavenly kingdom. And that makes all the difference between the public school and the Christian school. We can't just smugly say, oh, public schools, did you hear the latest, oh, my neighbor said, and clone that system, sterilize it, and say, that's enough. That's my burden for this. Another way of thinking of it is, are we primarily satisfied to just fulfill the requirements of the law, or do we see that we have a tremendous opportunity beyond that? To take it far beyond just the textbooks and what we do on an everyday basis. This is a rather wordy statement, but I found it an interesting thought. The purpose of Christian education is to place God at the center and to bring the individual into a right relationship with God and his fellows within the perspective of fundamental Christian truths about all of life. A Christian view of the universe, a Christian view of God, who is known in experience and in a historical process, a knowledge of Jesus Christ, who is accepted as Lord and Savior, a view of man which actually accounts for the experiences of damnation and salvation, an acceptance of the church as a people church in a covenant relation with God, and the experience of the learner in terms of the reality underlying these concepts. And that's a mouthful that takes quite a bit of processing to get everything lined out of it. My mind went to the story of Jesus in Luke 2, and I like to read this. You can follow along here on the screen, but there's one word that we often associate with education that is not used in this account. See if you can think about what it is. It came to pass that after 3 days they found him, Jesus, in the temple, sitting in the midst of the doctors, both hearing them and asking them questions. And all that heard him were astonished at his understanding and answers. And when they, his parents, saw him, they were amazed, and his mother said unto him, Son, why hast thou thus dealt with us? Behold, thy father and I have sought thee sorrowing. And he said unto them, How is it that ye sought me? Wist ye not? Don't you understand that I must be about my father's business? And they didn't understand the saying which he spake unto them. But, he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was subject unto them. But his mother kept all these sayings in her heart. And Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. What's the educational word that's not there? It says nothing about
knowledge.
It says nothing about facts. And while they weren't so impressed with Jesus' ability to spout off book learning, they were impressed with his wisdom. Notice what went into that. What was Jesus doing that got him beyond simple knowledge? Simple accumulation of facts. He was hearing, he was listening. He was asking questions. He was intent on doing his father's business, and he was subject to his parents. And in this last statement, I see a direct correlation between each of those 4 points and what he was. He heard them, he listened, and he increased in wisdom. He asked questions, and he increased in stature, or I like to think of that as maturity, or the restraint of years. He was intent on doing his father's business and had favor with God. And he was subject unto his earthly authorities and had favor with man. And what more could we ask for a student that graduates from our schools than that last statement? Even if they failed academically. And most of you don't know me, but if you would learn to know me well, you would soon discover that I in no means, no way, need to run down high academic standards. That's not my intention at all. I very firmly believed in high academic standards. But really, at the end of the day, that's the basis on which we push for high academic standards. And my fear is simply this. It works this way in business, and you may have seen this. Granddad starts the business. And he puts the energy, he puts the vision, he puts the late nights, he puts the blood, sweat, and tears, so to speak, into that business. Dad comes along, and he inherits the business. He still has to work to keep it going, and he keeps it going. And then along come the grandsons. They never had to work for it. They don't really appreciate what they have. And it's often lost in the third generation. And that's my concern. My two grandfathers negotiated with the state to allow the Mennonites the privilege of starting a Christian day school in their community in the late 50s. I see my generation coming along and having no idea. We didn't work for that at all. We didn't have to negotiate with the state. We don't know anything about that. And so it's pretty easy for us to take a cheap view of what we have. And I know in a sense I'm preaching to the choir because, hey, we're all teachers, right? Maybe I should be talking to the parents. But it's like an older brother said about the church heritage. You have what I did not have. Don't throw it away just because it was given to you. And I would like to increase our vision, our passion for communicating that. So like I said earlier, I'd like to sort of guide our vision with some broad brush and then give some opportunities for us to collaborate in smaller groups to actually talk about things that you're facing and then, you know, share them with the whole group. I'd like to start with 5 reasons that we do have curriculum. Why the books? Do you have any thoughts? Did you come up with anything? Why, if we're going beyond the books, why are we still concerned about academics?
Provide structure.
Structure, that's a good one.
Systematic way of covering the facts.
Exactly. So if the primary reason that we have school is to teach facts and techniques and skills, we have to have some basis on which to do that. So I didn't give you very much space there to write that down, but our primary job is to transmit facts. It's important to have that plan so that a graduate from our schools, whether that's a 8th grade graduate or 10th grade graduate or 12th grade graduate or whatever, has the minimum skills that are expected. If you aim at nothing, you will hit it every time. And the school's curriculum is, or the books, are a very important part of that to ensure that they meet those testing goals, those national standards. Without a curriculum, it's doubtful that any of us would walk into a classroom and get everything covered in a year that is necessary to do that. Textbooks are also organized units of thought. That thought came out. It's the plans and the lessons where this is your whole 10-year goal. You're not going to get to 10 or 12 grades unless you achieve in each grade along the way what needs to be achieved. And particularly, you've been there, take a brand new third grade teacher, you're going to have a very hard time knowing exactly how much they have to cover without the curriculum. So I'm in no means denigrating the textbooks. Structure. Children thrive on structure and a measured schedule. And if you haven't discovered that yet, you will discover it when you have children of your own. Disrupt the routine and bad things start to happen. So the schedule is enhanced and made possible by the curriculum. Here are the bite-sized pieces. We can fit it into our schedule and make things work. So that's the brief why of the curriculum. But I think we would all agree that if we simply stop there, we really haven't achieved the full potential of what we can do with our schools. So I picked five, and these are certainly not all-inclusive, they're certainly not exclusive, and they're certainly really nothing new. But these are five essentials that I think cover a bulk of what we need to achieve beyond the books. I'd like to discuss them briefly, and then I think we'll take a couple minutes after each of these just to collaborate a little bit. So five essentials beyond the books. And I started with this one because I think it is the umbrella that covers so much of the others. Godliness. Our goal should be for our students to be more like God when they leave our classrooms than what they were when they came in. We're concerned not just for the mechanics, but for their heart condition. And there's a sense in which that is a community effort. But we have our role to play in that. And we can't make up totally for a deficit within the home or within the church or whatever, but we daren't let our end of the bargain down. I read an interesting account of two men, and I get the impression, I didn't get a chance to look up exactly who they were, but I get the impression that they were well-known debaters of their time. And they were debating whether it is right to influence a child and try to direct their thinking. And the one said, no, it's not right. It's unfair to influence the child's mind until he is old enough, till the years of discernment when he can make his own choices. Now, the other fellow didn't say much, but he took his friend, I don't know if it was the same day or a couple days later, he took his friend out to his garden, which he had been neglecting, and he said, this is my botanical garden. And the friend who thought it's unfair to children to direct them was horrified. He said, this isn't a botanical garden, this is a weed patch, it's covered with weeds. Oh no, his friend said, that's only because it hasn't yet come to the age of discernment and choice. And the weeds have taken the liberty to grow in the meantime, but it would be unfair of me to prejudice the soil toward growing roses and strawberries. And his friend got the point. I don't know if he was converted, but he got the point. And that's the way it is with children. If we take that mindset, boys will be boys, which they will, but if we use that as a cop-out, we are actually doing them a tremendous disservice. So I have a number of sub-points here to get our thinking started, and then I'd like to hear some from you. I think obedience is a fundamental beyond the books. Sometimes we shrink from this. You know, I've heard the label, you know, strict, harsh. Rebellion is the sin of witchcraft. You know, that's obedience is just a core.
But not just, you will obey because I said so, but to teach them or help them discover the joy of doing right because it's right. And the joy of doing right even when nobody sees it, when the teacher's not away. That's one thing that was one of the biggest griefs of mine to me, was to have a group of students that I could not trust when I needed to walk out of the classroom. That was just a very uncomfortable situation. The joy of self-discipline. I don't have to discipline you if you discipline yourselves to do right. Make your own rules in a certain sense. I shouldn't have to make rules for everything. You should have an inner standard. And I think that comes with a relationship with the students, not a buddy-buddy relationship, but a relationship that acknowledges and blesses when they do take that tactic. Hey, I saw you, I've said to students, jot them a little note, I saw you start to do this and then quit. And that means a lot. Forgiveness. Forgiving themselves, forgiving others. Forgiveness is a godlike characteristic that we all need to grow in. One of the things that I always like to do when I had to mete out discipline to a student, some type of correction or punishment, was to say, okay, here's what you did that was wrong. Here's what we're going to have to do because of it. And when that is finished, the slate is clear. As far as I'm concerned, there is no more issue. There's nothing between us. And I think that's an important thing to communicate to children. Children will feel suspicion if it's there. Reverence. What tone do we expect for devotions and for Bible class and for other times of approaching God? It wasn't long into my teaching that it really began to bother me how, when we were all together as a school and would come to time for prayer, there was so much noise. You know, fidget, 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 shuffle, shuffle, shuffle. Songbooks. And so I began to take the tactic that I did not start praying until it was quiet. And it took quite a while until we could get to a point where that was the expected thing. And, you know, it always requires maintenance. But I think that set a tremendous standard for them in how they approached prayer. Another one that I think is important to cultivating godliness is devotion. And devotion, I simply mean teach them the deliberate planning that it requires to take time in the day for God. And again, I'll just give you one way that I tried to do that. We had Bible once a week, and so they would have all week to work on their Bible lesson. Well, you know how that goes. So, number one, I'm going to help them plan throughout the week, work at it throughout the week. Number two, I think it taught them a lesson in taking time for God first 15 minutes after our normal devotions. Each day, we worked on Bible. Some of them didn't take all 5 mornings of the week to get it done, but that was the expectation. You work on Bible, you dig into it, and I really felt that that brought a sense of reverence, a sense of devotion. We start the day by each personally digging in to the Bible, not just collectively, but personally. And that was just one thing that I found to be a huge blessing in teaching them that they have to put effort and planning into seeking out God. Another very important godly trait is respect. And we face this like we've probably never faced it before. But how we as teachers talk about the civil authorities and politics and all of that speaks volumes. I also took it as a personal challenge in the last number of years, a conscious challenge, to look for opportunities to reinforce to my students subtly the importance of them respecting and obeying their parents. So in a spelling word, when I would read the spelling words and make a sentence, if it was a word like counselor, I would use a sentence like, a godly youth's number one counselor should be his parents. It wasn't a sermon, but I hope that by weaving that into the everyday fabric, it just reinforced it. Look for ways to do that. Honesty. I have noticed a trend in at least some classrooms of not taking dishonesty as seriously as what we used to. At least when I compare it to my growing up years, dishonesty was a serious issue. And I think that we are going to pay a terrible price if we do not continue to deal decisively with dishonesty. By the time a child is old enough to come to school, they probably have a pretty good idea of whether what they're doing is honest or dishonest. And without a whole lot of, well, now you understand, I think it's a lot clearer than that. But the last one I have here on my list is purity. Don't be suspicious, but do be realistic about human nature, particularly in the vulnerable grades. Help your students evaluate what's funny and what's not funny. And that'll go a long way. So how do we do it? Before we break up and talk a little bit, what's the number one way that we teach godliness? By example. And we all have so far to go on this that I was thinking when I was preparing this, what am I doing? What am I doing saying do this by example when I failed so often? But I read the account of a letter that a young man sent to Thomas Carlyle, who was a Scottish essayist and teacher. And he said, "Mr. Carlyle, I wish to be a teacher. Will you tell me the secret of successful teaching?" And Carlyle wrote back this: "Be what you would have your pupils be. All other teaching is unblessed mockery." And that, I think, is the goal for all of us. Think of the difference between the cry of the Civil War soldiers when they would go into battle, "Officers to the rear," versus George Washington in the ambush on Braddock's defeat, going to the front and rallying the troops even though he received numerous bullets through his own coat. Leading by example versus corralling from behind makes a huge difference. Our goal should be that when we come to the end of our usefulness, it could be said of us as it was of Elijah, "The spirit of Elijah fell upon Elisha. Follow me as I follow Christ." And again, I know we know this, but we should not be vastly different in the classroom than what we are on a normal day. And I think particularly this can catch us as young teachers, where we're tempted to relate on a totally different level to our students. We almost become less mature than what we normally would be because we're trying to relate to them on another level outside of school. And that can be hugely detrimental. I heard of one teacher that was telling his students all about how he had been out on snowy roads the night before, carrying on, trying to scare the girls that were riding with him, sliding around on the roads, and lost control and wiped the mirror off his vehicle. And this was ha ha ha, funny. I cringed. I've also heard of teachers who did themselves the disservice of bragging about all the shenanigans that they pulled when they were in school. Don't be surprised if that comes home to roost. All right, let's take a couple minutes and can just sort of spin around, talk to people that are seated next to you. There's a couple things you could discuss. Discuss what I've shared, add to it, subtract from it. You could discuss specific areas of concern in your school or in your classroom that you want to sharpen vision on, or you could each share one thing that you plan to work on this coming year in terms of helping your students be more godly. So I'll give you 3 minutes or so here, get some conversation going, and then see if you have something to share with the rest of us when you're finished. Go ahead. All right, I hate to interrupt your conversation, but I also want to make sure that we have time to get across. So continue these conversations. I just overheard a very interesting one. You were talking about respect to students. Anything you'd like to share on that? So I think that's a good point that I did not cover.
And I was telling them, I don't know if it's as much of a trap for new teachers is more to be the buddy, mm-hmm. but for a seasoned teacher is to not respect your students. We can, as teachers, and maybe this is just us men teachers, I don't know, we can tend to trade war stories. Guess what my kids did today? Guess how I straightened them out?
Yeah.
That's not respectful, and the students can feel that.
Right. Yeah, that's a challenge for us. And one of the challenges of the day and age in which we live is that there's pretty much open season on authority. And I have had situations already where legitimate discipline done in a very mild and loving yet firm way was labeled disrespect. And so it really makes you tentative on some of that type of thing. Anything else that you'd like to quickly share before we go on to the next one? From your discussion. Well, let's go on to the second one, humility. Are you godly and then humble, or are you humble and then godly? I wasn't sure which order to put these two in, but I think they go together. And the first thing that I think it's important for us to teach our children is their lack of knowledge. It doesn't matter how much they think they know or how much they actually know. they really know nothing. And I like to think of knowledge as a circle. You may have heard this or seen this illustration before, but a child starts with a very little circle of knowledge. And in comparison to what he knows, he has a tremendous frontier of exposure. The edge of the circle was exposure to new things. He has a tremendous frontier. Everywhere he goes, he bumps into new things that he didn't know about before. And so his circle increases in area, but guess what? It also increases in circumference. Because as his knowledge increases, there are that many more things to learn that he had no clue about. And this just keeps on going. It keeps on going when you're 40, 50, 60 the whole way. Just an example. Child sees a flower, he picks the flower, he examines the flower, he learns about flowers, then he learns about pollen, then he learns about pollination, then he learns about bees, and he learns about beehives, and he learns about hive society, and he learns about pheromones, which are the chemicals that the bees use to communicate, and he learns about the waggle dance that the bees do to tell the other bees where honey is, and then he learns about honey and how it's made, and he learns about compound eyes, and he learns about optics, and on and on and on. And there is a danger in this, a very real danger. The humanist gets so wrapped up in that expanding circle of knowledge. It's like, wow, look at me, look at how much I know. And that's where 2 Timothy talks about ever learning, but never really coming to the knowledge of the truth. But the Christian looks at this fact that every time he expands his area, his horizon expands, and he realizes that the only person that can grasp all that knowledge is his God. And he falls to his knees in awe, and he says, woe is me, I don't know anything. What is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him? And one of the things that I tell my students over and over, we are thinking God's thoughts after him. The only reason that this all exists, the only reason we can learn this is because God thought it, and it's in existence. And so we are treading on holy ground, so to speak, thinking God's thoughts after him. We are really, 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 really little. And so true education humbles rather than puffs up. Christian education humbles rather than puffs up. I don't think Will Durant was a Christian educator, but the quote that I have there on the front of your handout, 60 years ago, I knew everything. Now I know nothing. Education is a progressive discovery of our own ignorance. So acknowledge your limitations. I don't understand this. I'll be quite frank with you. I've said that in science. This is on the edge of my knowledge. I don't grasp it all. I'd always like to acknowledge to my students when we'd study something like the atomic model, and we talk about, well, we have the quantums and we have all of the electron spin and we have the quantum numbers, and that's all man's theory. And I firmly believe that if God laughs and shakes his head, he laughs and shakes his head when he hears me trying to teach students about the atom or gravity or anything else. And I think that's a hugely valuable thing to always have in front of our students, how little we actually know. Part of humility is their equality with their fellows. Growing up in school, I was the social misfit. And so I have, throughout my teaching career, had a very soft spot in my heart for those who are the victims of social prejudice. Don't allow prejudice in your classroom. Combat the stereotypes and the put-downs. There are always students that are lower on the pecking order. Look out for them. I noticed some shenanigans that were going on at the class table targeting this one student, and I addressed it with the boys that were doing the targeting. I simply told them that I know this is a difficult situation socially. But you do yourself a lot of credit if you simply treat the other boy with respect and cut out the dirty looks and the shoves and all the little subtle things. That response should be swift and it should be decisive. There's a fine line even when teasing becomes mocking, that we have to watch out for. Of course, we know that bullying's out, right? I wouldn't expect necessarily to see my students pummeling another fellow and really punching his lights out. But what about the emotional bullying that happens in our circles? And so I simply had the policy all of my teaching years, we don't save lunch seats. We don't have three students off over here eating lunch and three off over here eating lunch and three out where I can't see them eating lunch. We just all eat lunch together in a circle. And I think that helped hugely in minimizing some of that. Don't allow them to denigrate their backgrounds. Let's face it, in the church climate that we find ourselves in, there's a lot of moving and a lot of people that are carrying baggage with them. And when that comes into the classroom in a venomous way, it can be a huge detriment. I think we should try to teach them to disagree respectfully. There's a respectful way to say, well, I don't like cooked carrots that well, but, you know, without this, and that can start first and second grade, please. Because if you let it go in first and second and third and fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh and eighth, then I have to deal with it. We should be the leaders in the right when controversy erupts. We should be there to guide without taking a personal stake in it. Not necessarily that we shut it down and say, no, don't talk like that, but guide them in thinking. Apologize. Teachers need to apologize too. Teach them to apologize. Teach them to look for strengths in their fellow students rather than just running them down. Courtesy, I think, is an outgrowth of humility. Courtesy says, you're just as good as what I am. I'm not any more special than what you are. You were made in the image of God the same as I. And in fact, knowing myself, I'm less godlike than what you are. So I will say, yes, sir, no, ma'am. I will address the teacher with the proper title, and I'll address other teachers that aren't my direct teacher with the proper title. I'll hold the door. I'll say thank you. We can teach children what to do when they sneeze or what to do when they burp or how not to burp. We can teach them hygiene. We can teach them how to clean up the trash from lunch. I was thinking this morning of a 10th grader that was messing with a salt shaker in the school kitchen. And then I'm squeezing the thing, popping the bottom out, and I got there, salt was all over the kitchen floor. I said, okay, who's responsible to clean this up? Well, I didn't try it. I said, well, the other grades are coming. They're going to track this stuff all over the place. Now's the time to go get the waste can and the dust pan and clean this up. He was highly unimpressed, but anyway, we got it done. I always like to acknowledge gifts that my students gave me by simply jotting them a thank you note. And when I had 21 of them, that took forever and a day. But I think it was important to set that example. Another thing that goes with humility is moderation. We live in an instant world. We want it, we've got it. Pay for Prime and you've got it next day. And our students get that mentality, we get that mentality, where the world revolves around us. The ancient Chinese called their country Cheng Kuo, simply meant middle country. They literally believed that they were the geographical center and the cultural center of the world. They literally believed that the world revolved around them. And that's how we tend to be as humans. And so a simple illustration from my classroom was the classroom ventilation issue. We didn't have air conditioning, so come in from recess, oh, I'm so hot, flung the windows up, turn the fan on high speed. And particularly on a fall or spring day when there was plenty of cool air to bring in, well, you start moderately. And, you know, then if you need more ventilation, you open more ventilation, you can help them think through that. It's not an instant fix. I've known of teachers that changed the curriculum because their students complained about how hard the curriculum was or dropped courses. That's not teaching them moderation. Sportsmanship is a huge component of humility. Congratulate the winners. Good job. don't brag or sulk, and again, we can model that quite effectively on the playground. All right, give you a couple minutes to talk about anything on that point before we go on to excellence. All right, any thoughts you'd like to share that you've discussed?
We've got an open question. How do you teach courtesy? Holding the door for girls, saying yes, sir, and no, ma'am. And
what are your thoughts?
Well, I know my wife has a book, and she teaches a class every year. I can't remember the title of it. It's a very good book about social graces. Mm-hmm. And she insists on it first of the year, for fifth and sixth grade. And yeah, it's I'll try to find the title of it. But so, yeah, it's surprising how little some of these families know. Mm-hmm. And some of us think, oh, that's so rude the way they did this, but they just don't know.
Right. That's the big dilemma. How much, and I'd like to wrap up by just talking a little bit about that. How much does the school, how far can the school go without casting a bad light on the home? I would say model it, first of all.
Well, one of the first questions I can remember as a boy in school, chafing under having, we use the terms brother and sister, mm-hmm. our school now where it teaches Mr. and Miss, but chafing under that, like, who do they think they are that I have to call them brother? But since then, circulating in the secular world, especially the business world, where that is the respect, I want to call somebody Mr. because the position they hold. How do you cross that line without making them chafe under it? On the average, I'm not saying every specific incident.
Doesn't it go back to what you're saying about the open season on authority? That's what I would say initially.
I really question whether the students who had trouble calling me by my proper title, whether I was addressed that way at home by their parents. So there's only so much we can do to internalize it. There is an aspect in which some of that obedience comes before knowledge. But we have to be careful in how we approach that. But we do set the standards. And if it's in the schools where I taught, it was a school policy, then we are responsible to enforce it, whether they understand it or not. And hopefully, over time, a school culture can develop in which it is not such a resistance, but school culture can very quickly go the other way too, depending on who moves in, who moves out.
Yeah,
how that goes. There's a real sense in which the school can maintain and polish, but it can hardly start from scratch on some of those things. Yes?
I think for me as a lady teacher, allowing my fellow men teachers and upper grade boys to do that to me,
mm-hmm.
like letting them open the door,
mm-hmm.
I suddenly realized that I have to let my 17-year-old boys open the door for me. If I want them to do that for the girls,
right.
I need to be modeling that.
That's a good point.
And that was a good realization for me.
And in society, yes, some women can actually bristle
yeah.
at a man doing that. Very good. Well, let's move on to excellence. I've always appreciated Psalm 8. It's beautiful. King James Version language. There's a beauty to the poetry. But I've come to appreciate it more in thinking of it, what David is actually saying. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is thy name in all the earth, who set thy glory above the heavens. And yet, out of the mouth of babes and sucklings, you've ordained strength. What is man that thou art mindful of him? He's just a little lower than the angels, and yet you crowned him with glory and honor and given him dominion over everything. And I think we see a pattern there. God did an excellent job. A very good job, Genesis said, of making us. And if we take this lackluster approach to utilizing what he's given us, we're failing to measure up to that excellence. Just take the example of speech. All the intricacies of speech, the gums, the teeth, the palate, the tongue, the lips, the lungs, the diaphragm, the voice box, and so it's wonderful in the way we're created to produce sounds that make sense and aren't just grunts and winks and moos. But it's also wonderful how our ears are designed to take that. And you could go through the intricacy of the ear. Now, how is God going to feel if we don't expect our students to develop their speaking and their writing and their listening in a similarly excellent fashion? Not for their own glory again, but for the glory of God. So we have verses like, seek that ye may excel to the edifying of the church. Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. Love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind and with all thy strength. So we should expect the best effort from all. Now the best effort for one may vary significantly from the best effort for another. And we have to be sensitive to that. There are some students that I would give an A on a composition that had I received it from another student, I would have given them an F. But we expect according to capacity. It's like one place I read, we should not allow 10 talent students to do 2 talent work. Even if school is easy, we should still expect them to excel. I've had students that could cruise through on B's when they should have been pulling straight A's. And that is almost more challenging than helping a student who's doing their best and failing. Hold high standards. I don't mean impossibly high, but again, your aim determines trajectory. Have them, hold them, and meet them, and be consistent. If you're like me, you would tend to let things slide, and all of a sudden one day it's like, hey, what's going on here? Yeah, boom, we're going to... So what is the standard of excellence? Just because I got sick of it, now we have an excellent standard? Or was the standard there being met all along? Complete sentences. Just a very simple thing that is excellent and does have long-term educational benefit, too. When you correct them, encourage them. sometimes I think I erred on the side of perfectionism. And we need to be careful that we do not constantly, they can never achieve. There is a balance between excellence and perfectionism, and we need to help them find that. Never discourage anyone who makes progress, no matter how slow the progress is, I think is a good rule of thumb. Let's hold our little discussion time to the end of the next point. I want to make sure that we have time to wrap this up. So let's go on to usefulness. Usefulness simply means, are these people just educated, or can they actually accomplish something? Did you ever hear of someone being so educated that they're worth nothing? I'm not sure that that happens too much in our conservative Mennonite circles. But a person can go through high school, college, graduate school, PhD school, and not be able to change their entire. And that's not the type of students that we are trying to educate. We want them to be able to function on their own. We want them to be useful. And so we need to teach them how to learn on their own. The old Chinese proverb, give me a fish and I eat for a day. Teach me to fish and I eat for life. If our students rely on us the whole way through school and we never teach them how to think on their own, the day that they get out of school, they're in trouble. So we give them clues to find the answer without telling them the answer. And it's like Mark said this morning, we make it more difficult for them to ask questions than to just go on and find it on their own. I would like to ask him if he had any tips for how to do that with 21 students. I could have done it, but it would have taken all day for one subject. So our ultimate goal would be the desire for them to have the desire and the tools to continue their education on their own. Somebody asked an old farmer, how much education do you have? And he replied, 6 years of schooling and 2 years of learning. And that's a man that learned usefulness and was useful without a teacher holding it over him all the time. The person who graduates today and stops learning tomorrow is uneducated the day after, is another quote. Someone gave this analogy, and of course we're not necessarily aiming to send students through graduate school. That's not necessarily our goal. But if life is a huge field, an endless field, and you're responsible to clear it and plow it and harvest it for the rest of your life, your challenge is how to harvest the right crops in the largest amounts possible. And so, if you quit before high school, this was their analogy, and I don't necessarily endorse all of this, but their analogy was, you quit before high school, you have a hoe to work your field. But you can get started right away. You quit after high school, you have a dozen hand tools. You stop after college, and you have a rototiller with an unlimited amount of gasoline. You stop after graduate school, and you have a diesel tractor with a number of implements. This fifth step, I think, is where we want to come out, no matter where we're stopping our children's education. Don't ever stop, even after graduate school, and you'll gradually gather a whole series of tractors, combines, irrigation systems, everything you could possibly imagine you need for your field. And that should be our goal for our students. Do they have the life skills that they need to be successful? And I just put a plug in here to you younger grade teachers. Give them the scaffold that the later grades can build on. Because if that scaffolding is not put together from day one, it's very difficult. When I have seventh graders with virtually no reading comprehension, it is virtually impossible for me to teach them science and history because they cannot read a paragraph and dig the meat out of it. Think about how school prepares a child for life. The teacher is his boss. His classmates are his co-workers. So it doesn't really matter how wonderful of a time you had at school if you don't have the life skills when you come out. And sometimes I think we fail to teach our children that the real joy of school is in what they're studying, rather than in all of the extra stuff. We need extra things sometimes, but let's not make that the real meat. Do, are they going to have what they need to mix the complex insecticides? Are they going to know enough medical skills to debunk the alternate health stuff that's so prevalent? In other words, think of it in very practical terms. Are we simply entertaining, or are we equipping them? Verse in Philippians 4 that says he gave some apostles and some prophets, some pastors and teachers for the perfecting of the saints. And that word perfecting literally means complete furnishing, prepare, make ready, complete. Abraham Lincoln said, give me 6 hours to chop down a tree and I'll spend the first four sharpening the axe. And that is what school is doing. We are sharpening the axe for them to go to work. Disciplined habits. Can they set their own goals and schedules? Help them set up. I always like to do this on a short week or a short day. All right, get out a piece of scrap paper. What's the first thing that seventh grade should be working on today? What's next? Help them prioritize, and then they can work down through that checklist. Do they know how to take notes? Do they know how to pace themselves on a long-term project? We need to give them, and I couldn't think of a better way of putting this, time to play being adults. In other words, shop class. In essence, they're playing at being an adult. Craft class, art class. Give them chance to have devotions and to lead songs and to, I always had business meeting, a little business meeting for my students to pick team captains. It was just a way of them getting adult skills in a place where it was safe to make mistakes. I made it safe to make mistakes. You get up and you start leading and you're on the wrong time pattern, we'll just stop and we'll help you. And we're not going to laugh at you. And I always said, if somebody laughs at you, I'll take care of them. So that when they get to the actual adult life, the sum of the fear, at least, is gone. Help them make choices. Give them the wisdom to make choices. Help them with organization. I think having a paper plan in place for how students handle their own papers. Teach them that earning their own way is important. I always liked to work the math problems by hand, even if I had a calculator. When a student asked me a question, I would do it by hand. It was good for me, number one. Number two, I think it helped communicate that you get what you earn. Let's cover this last point and then I'll give you some time to talk. Kingdom service, and I think this is where it really comes down to it. We want to educate children that are going to commit themselves to kingdom service. Sacrificial living should be a way of life. Sacrificial living is strenuous work. And I think that's one thing that we fail to communicate to our students. Life is real, life is earnest. And if you don't work, be a model of putting the good of the school, the good of the community before your personal convenience. The study habits that our students learn in school are going to set profitable or poor precedents for their adult life. Think about how hard it's going to be to, you're welcome, how hard it's going to be for a child that never learned how to study the Bible on their own. I love to read and study, but it's hard enough for me to maintain the level of Bible study I should. Someone has said that biblical education is the process that takes one from being an unrestrained and ignorant child to a young person who is disciplined and trained into a pattern of conduct and thought according to the Word of God. And Thomas Henry Huxley, who was an agnostic, unwittingly gave one of the best lines that I've ever heard in terms of the goals of Christian education. Perhaps the most valuable result of all education is the ability to make yourself do the thing you have to do when it ought to be done, whether you feel like it or not. That was from an agnostic. Teach them to care about others. We held a prayer meeting every Monday morning, and I took prayer requests from them and had them pray for the prayer requests, and I think it communicated a kingdom vision. Change the schedule to accommodate the emotional needs. Go to their baptisms, go to their grandparents' viewings, if at all possible. Take time to answer questions outside the scope of the lesson that you know are on their mind. give them a service mindset, take them on mission trips, take them to do projects for other people, make sure that the Anabaptist worldview is infused into and the basis of all the subjects. And Mark made an interesting comment this morning that resonated with me. Teach them, and I don't have this one up here, but teach them convictions. Can they look at a curriculum that is maybe has some flaws and see those flaws and learn from them? There's a certain sense in which we can sterilize everything and they'll never learn what they should. What was the question that you wanted to make sure that we talked about? Okay, I'll give you, you know, 2 minutes here to follow up on anything, and then we'll wrap it up with the five cautions really quickly. So if you want to talk, we have about 5 minutes. I'll give you two of them to talk among yourselves and discuss anything that's on your mind, and then we'll talk about those five cautions yet. I think we're actually run over time here. This whole schedule thing has me goofed up, but I think we're actually supposed to be dismissing. So let's just quickly run across these five cautions. You're not your student's parents. I'm not suggesting that we take more upon ourselves than what we should, but I'm suggesting that we take it seriously what we should. Your student's parents are counting on you. Don't drop the ball. The church of tomorrow is in school today. You are under authority, it's not your party, and you do affect eternity. I like to think of it as a threefold cord where we each put the pressure, and if three cord parts of the cord put the pressure together, we're successful. And I wanted to get to this one, but going back to our iron bar at the beginning, think about how a child increases in value if we can teach them beyond the books.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.